forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast, now part of the Finding Genius Foundation. I have not only a guest, but a fan. He's told me he's listened to a bunch of podcasts, so I'm always happy about that. Dr. Kenneth R. Pelletier. We're going to talk about his book called Change Your Genes, Change Your Life. It's reputed to be a pioneering work in integrative medicine, epigenetics, and longevity, so looking forward to hearing about that. Ken is a clinical professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine, part of the Department of Family and Community Medicine, and Psychiatry. All of this at University of California School of Medicine in San Francisco, UCSF. And before I get any deeper into the bio and probably screw it up, I'll ask him to fill it in. So welcome, Ken.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah. When people have really extensive bios like you, it's difficult because there's so many things in there. But it shows that you've been around and you've been doing a lot of work for a long time. So tell me a bit about your background. Like, how did you get to the positions you're in right now and the work you're doing now? What was the journey like? A short story, if you don't mind.
You know. Yeah, I'll try to give you the short version. When I was in medical school, I dropped out for a year when I traveled to Europe and the Near East, North Africa, and I ended up on a little island in Greece, Tinos. And Tinos has a church where it's like for the Greek Orthodox, it's like Lourdes for the Catholics. It's a place of miracles. And I happened to be on that island when pilgrims were arriving. And I didn't see limbs regenerate or blindness cured, but I did see people who were in excruciating pain, unable to walk, clearly compromised in many different medical ways, who had come out of the church functional, alive, vital, and it did not conform to the biology I was learning. So when I came back to UCSF, I started a series of studies on what we ended up calling adept meditators. So these were individuals that could control bleeding, pain, infection, and studied them both when they were and were not meditating. And when they were meditating, they looked as though they were on vacation in a tropical paradise. I mean, they did not respond. And that led me to think, what is this sway, if you will, the mind has over the body? And that's continued to drive my interest and career. Trained as a cardiologist, but it's driven my career interest right up to the present time. I guess the thing I'll end on is a reviewer in the New York Times. I wrote a book in 1977 based on that research called Mind is Healer, Mind is Slayer. And the reviewer said, this new book, Change Your Genes, this is like Mind is Healer 50 years later, because in Mind is Healer, I demonstrated that we can have a major degree of regulation over our nervous system, our organs, our body chemistry. Now, what we're seeing is this extends right down to the genetic mechanism in every cell of our body. So that's my short history.
That's interesting. So let's delve into that topic more. Again, what was the premise of your book, you know, many years ago, 1977, and then we'll go into some of the differences now.
Well, in the mid-70s, there was still a major issue in biology, and the issue was that we had the voluntary and the involuntary nervous system, and never the twain shall meet. They were like parallel tracks, and I just didn't believe it, because if you think about it, you could hold your breath, which is voluntary, but at some point, your oxygen level would desaturate, and you'll gasp, and you'll start to breathe again, or you could hold your eyes open for a period of time, and then the eyeballs rise, and you need to blink. That's involuntary. So I knew that the two were actually more interrelated than the biology books were telling us. So the purpose in working with the adept meditators was to demonstrate that there was this clear interaction between the voluntary and involuntary nervous system, and that the voluntary nervous system was governed by beliefs and practices and had a profound, measurable impact. And when we published our study, this was in the mid-70s, the publisher or the editor, who's a skeptic at the University of Pennsylvania, they did not believe the findings. So we had to submit our data tape shapes. And as you know, in scientific papers, you have a submitted date and an accepted date. And our paper had a 1 year lag time between submitted for purposes of priority of discovery and accepted, because they reviewed all the data tapes and said, okay, this is real, but it was not considered to be a real effect in the 70s. So that, if you, again, kind of fast forwarding from the 70s to now, the scientific fact that we, in fact, control to a very marked degree our genetic expression is only a very new idea, probably 5 to 10 years old at this point, and it's just beginning to be explored and developed, as I've heard in some of your podcasts, you know, from scientists in the field that that is the case.
So how does the voluntary nervous system inform the function of the involuntary one? Are we able to, I guess, you know, the voluntary one is accessible to us. So through that, we probably could train and modulate the involuntary one, you know, like through meditation and other things. So what, you know, have you thought about that aspect of it? I'm sure you have. And what conclusions have you drawn?
Well, absolutely. And we can understand the neurochemistry of how it occurs, what the if you will, the pathways are. However, having said that, I've worked with patients who have no idea, children that have no idea about neurochemistry and biochemical pathways and neurological pathways. And they can, in fact, change their blood pressure, their heart rate, all of these autonomic functions. Now, on the other hand, I've had adults that know all the neurochemistry and pathways. They can't do it. So there's something about giving, if you will, a request or command to our involuntary nervous system that it follows, but it needs practice. And that was the reason for studying the adept meditators. If you said to me, yeah, I want to learn to play the piano, I'd say, well, you need lessons. You'd say, of course. But I was always amazed how many people wanted to learn how to play something infinitely more complex, which is the human central nervous system. And you say you need lessons, and they kind of shrug their shoulders like, why? So it's not just, I think, and it happens. I think, and then it takes practice and repetition over time until the voluntary nervous system creates pathways to the involuntary nervous system. And then you have a connection established between the two.
So what's an example of a skill that could be learned by, let's say, active meditation or other means?
Well, our study in the 70s was a study of pain. And honestly, I was not at all interested in pain. It was just a good way to get a grant to study the voluntary control. And what we found is, again, there were many different ways. We had 7 or 8 adept meditators who each had a very idiosyncratic way of controlling bleeding and pain and infection. And how that, I'll give you an example. One of the subjects we had was a man named Jack Schwartz, who was a meditation teacher from Holland. And he had been imprisoned during the Dutch rebellion in Nazi Germany. And he was tortured. And when he was tortured, he passed out, and he was raised as a Catholic, saw himself at the foot of the cross at Calgary. And he remembered the words, Father, why hast thou forsaken me? And he, in his mind, he always thought that Christ was looking up at the sky. And in his vision, Christ looked into the eyes of all the people at the foot of the cross. When he looked at Jack's eyes, Jack immediately came out of his reverie from being beaten by the Nazi officer and said, I love you, to the Nazi officer. So from that point, they thought—
That must have made him mad.
Well, they thought he was really crazy at that point. But from that point on, he had this marked ability to control the bleeding and pain. So that we really wanted to demonstrate. It was the first time. There had been anecdotal reports. Elma Green at the Menninger Foundation had conducted unstructured experiments that were really considered to be anecdotal. And Elma was very helpful to me. But I wanted to do it in a very structured way. It was before the kind of computerized sophistication we have now. And the subjects looked like a Christmas tree. They had so many electronic leads from the EEG and respiration and cardiotachometer and heart rate regularity, peripheral circulation. They looked like a Christmas tree. But it was the first time, unequivocally, we demonstrated that when a person under meditation decided they were not going to respond to pain at a neurological level, you did not see evidence of spiking on the cortex of the brain, and you did not see bleeding subsequently when they had a normal bleeding time, when they were not meditating, et cetera, that they were able to alter these autonomic functions absolutely unequivocally and with outcomes and data. So that was a real breakthrough. That was probably 74 or 75.
What do you what did the subjects say about the pain, about the nature of it? Like, how did you determine that they were experiencing it or not experiencing it? You know, EEG, et cetera. Like, what did the equipment tell you versus what did the person tell you?
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
That's a great question. So one of the criticisms of Elmer Green's research was that these people are abnormal. There are people who do not feel pain. And so they were abnormal. They didn't feel pain. So we did standard pain tests and they responded. You could see on their EEG and then their nervous system, their heart rate rose, cortisol rose in their bloodstream. So we knew that we documented these were people that when they were not meditating, they had a normal response to pain. Then when they were meditating, what we found is that there was no cortical activity in the brain, no rise in blood pressure, no rise in heart rate. And when we asked them, there was one, a convicted drug smuggler. That's a different story. But we had him come actually from San Quentin prison as he'd learned autonomic control because he'd been shot a number of times in smuggling. And he said, I had to learn how to not cry out and control my bleeding and pain so I wouldn't get arrested. So we got him released from San Quentin with highway patrol officers bringing him in his orange jumpsuit to the lab to be studied. And I asked him, what does it feel like? He would pierce his face. So he would take 3 bicycle spokes, put them through one side of his cheeks, through his mouth, and out the other side. Now, this is very difficult. It takes a lot of physical exertion to do that. So you saw all the indicators of stress were clear. And then he would go into a meditation, everything would drop and flatten out. And I said, so what does that feel like? And he said, well, when I'm not meditating and I have something painful, it's sharp, it's distracting. Literally, it hurts in the way that you or I say something hurts. He said, but when I'm meditating, I feel the pressure. He said, it's like pressing my finger on my face. I can feel the pressure of the spoke going through, but it's not sharp, it's not distracting, and it doesn't hurt. And I thought that was consistent among virtually all the adept meditators that we studied. They blunted the sensation. It didn't disappear, it didn't go away altogether, but they were able to blunt the sharp, distracting, what we would term painful occurrence.
Well, you know, they also, the thing that sticks out to me is, they were able to endure very high levels of pain until the meditation set in. Like, how long did they have to meditate for before they experienced the pain, let's say, going away or being blunted and turning just into pressure? So let's say it's a minute, you know, they still have to withstand the pain for that period of time, which a lot of people without practice, I don't think could do.
No, they couldn't. And that's one of those, our admonishment was this is an experiment, don't do it at home. And they would usually begin a meditation, and we would ask them to tell us when they were ready to self-inflict. So these were self-inflicted wounds, penetrations through the forearm, through the face, through the bicep. So these were all severe self-inflicted wounds. And when it usually would take anywhere between 5 minutes and as long as 10 minutes, when they would go from being alert and externally oriented to relaxed and quiet and internally oriented so they could tolerate the pain. At that point, they would give us a signal usually by just inflecting their finger, and then they would engage in this painful stimulus and we would measure what happened. They would usually keep the probes in place for anywhere between 5 and 10 minutes. And when they would remove them, again, you'd see these spikes that they were clearly feeling pain as these needles, very often bicycle spokes, were removed. But again, no bleeding. We followed them for infection. They never sterilized any of these things. We followed them for infection for a month afterwards, and there was no infection. In fact, there was very little reddening around the point of penetration.
Well, you probably know about Wim Hof, you know, yes, who has gone into extreme cold, and it sounds similar. You know, he was able to, I don't know what the temperature of the water was, maybe 40-something, and he was able to stay there for like an hour and a half, which was way beyond what anyone had done. And then he was injected with some kind of, toxin, and he was able to fend it off when he usually really incapacitates people. So he seems like another example of this.
He's a perfect example. I was actually at a conference with him in Rome a couple of years ago and met him and heard him lecture, and I'd heard of him before, but he was planning to go to the top of Kilimanjaro. He was going to hike without oxygen and without, you know, with just a pair of shorts and barefoot and go up into the snow on Kilimanjaro. And he wanted to document that he was able to tolerate the pain objectively. He wanted some evidence that it was more than just the duration of time, that he actually was not feeling the cold, not feeling the pain. And I agreed to be part of the team that went with him, and then any number of things happened, and the hike got canceled due to political issues, and we ended up not doing it. But he is a perfect example of that kind of person. There was also, when 48 Hours was a popular television show maybe 10 years ago, Dan Rather was on there, and they had a circus performer in Canada who could do self-mutilation, penetrations, and they brought the video to me. I was on the faculty at Stanford at the time, and they wanted to show me the videos and have me comment on, did I think this was real and why and what was occurring? And this was he was a clear example of another person. I did not know him, didn't know of him, who was able to do exactly the same thing. But again, all of these people, Wim Hof, Jack Schwartz, this man from Canada, all of them had to practice to do this. It takes a lot of discipline and a lot of focus. This isn't something you just run out and try tomorrow. It's something you need to practice in order to achieve.
Any of these experiments so extreme as to be, I guess, ghastly or gory, or, you know, like how far can this ability go? Or this is plenty enough? Like what percentage of the population would be able to do this just walking in off the street, regardless of their pain tolerance, for instance?
I don't think anyone could without practice, because all of them were practiced. That's why we call them adept meditators, because these were people who'd engaged in usually a lifelong practice. So I don't doubt very, there are people, again, who do not have pain sensitivity. It's a really small percentage of the people, but all of these individuals had a kind of a normal pain response when they weren't meditating.
So where does the title of your book come from then? You say change your genes, change your life, but about epigenetic change, or, you know, how does this dovetail?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned that there was a New York Times critic who reviewed my book, The Change Your Genes, and he had reviewed Mind is Healer probably 50 years ago now. And he said, oh, I get it. Change your genes is the same phenomena, but happening at a cellular level. And that's precisely the case, because we now know that stress, that diet, that physical activity, pharmacology, environmental exposure has a profound direct impact on every single cell and every single gene within every single cell. So we can trace it right down from the level of the nervous system and organ system, which we did in the mid-70s. Now we're looking at the intracellular level of biochemical changes that induce either expression or suppression of genetic predispositions. That, I mean, even to this day, I've been doing this now for 7 or 8 years, I am amazed the extent to which this is possible and the variety of ways in which it's achieved.
Well, besides, I guess you can call it, getting up on stage and doing crazy things, sticking needles to your arm, et cetera. What are some other really interesting and amazing things that people have been able to do, not related to pain?
Well, I don't have experiences with phenomena other than the self-inflicted pain, because, again, that's where you're able to document when someone is and is not feeling pain. So it gives you a good objective outcome. And you ask, how gory are they? Well, some people seeing their face penetrated by three bicycle spokes get pretty ill. We have one anecdote that will illustrate the extent of it. But Jack Schwartz, after we did the research with him, we were asked to do grand rounds. This was at UCSF School of Medicine. And so we did, we did a presentation, did the formal data and the outcome of the studies. And then they asked Jack if he would do a demonstration. So he stood at the podium in the front of the room, and they draped the podium in a white towel, and Jack penetrated his bicep. Now, the bicep has a major arterial supply, but he was not cautious about where he penetrated his bicep. But you could see the strain of pushing a needle, a bicycle spoke, sharpened bicycle spoke through your bicep takes a lot of effort. So you can see him really straining. He pushed the needle through and then he was in a trance. I could tell he was in trance. And there was one doctor a couple of rows back who said, oh, what's he going to do now? Breathe fire. Yeah, right? Kind of in a very snide response. And Jack heard that. And I could tell that he shifted. I knew him well enough by studying him a number of times in the lab. I knew when he shifted from being attached to non-detached, and he moved out of the non-detachment of his meditation. And he basically said, you know, I'll show you. And he pulled it out and he just pulled it. And there was instantaneous spirit arterial bleeding. The podium was soaked. The first row of doctors, all the white coats, jumped up to try to help him. He held up his hand, held out his arm, and he just yelled him off. And it was like turning off a spigot. He just stopped this spurting arterial bleeding in a matter of seconds. And in some ways, it was a very gory demonstration, but it was even more impressive than the kind of controlled stuff he did in the lab. This was a real life arterial bleed that he turned off like a spigot. So that was probably the most gory extreme that I've seen. I don't want to see anything more gory than that, but it did demonstrate that this was an extreme ability that people have. It's even true in animals. I know a leading dolphin researcher that when dolphins are frightened, or when they perceive themselves to be in situations of aggression, it's almost impossible to do a blood draw. Their arterial, their peripheral vascular system shuts down to the point of where you cannot draw blood. Mm. When they're relaxed and quiet and playful, you can easily do a blood draw. So it happens in all, I believe it happens in all mammals, but to find it at, with such a pronounced degree in humans is quite astounding.
So how can someone that's studying the epigenetics of pain, or chronic pain, acute pain, et cetera, might be someone good to speak to, I guess, and partner and maybe go further with experiments on these kind of people if they're willing?
It would be. I gave up doing that.
It was too much of a pain.
Yeah, too much. Oh, you are good. Yes, that's a good way to put it. I just couldn't take it anymore. I mean, I want seven or eight of these people doing these, you know, really potentially life-threatening self-inflicted wounds. And it was just not something I wanted. I proved my point and demonstrated that the voluntary and involuntary nervous system were a continuum, not a separate parallel set of tracks, that people could do it. There was objective evidence, and that was as much as I wanted to achieve. And the field of epigenetics is different than that. It's less spectacular. You don't see these kind of dramatic results. But to me, the epigenetics is really fascinating because, again, you can measure this at the cellular level. And all of us, I mean, I've bombarded, I get hundreds of emails a week with the latest panacea. This will make you, will turn your hair from gray to dark. It'll give you a better sex life. You'll be more intelligent. You'll live 10 years longer.
But Ken, here's something you could do that maybe is not so upsetting. You know, let's say I'm just making this up. Let's say there's a drug that has known side effects pretty much every time of a headache. Why not get people that are really good at getting rid of pain, and you know, they take this drug, it's not really harmful, and they get a headache, and you can see that on your sensors and all that in your equipment. So they're not sticking needles through their eyeball or anything gross, but they have a headache and they clear it. And then maybe you could do some experimentation where you wouldn't be horrified by seeing this or traumatized, but you're still able to test the effects that you're looking for. Maybe something like that.
That's very possible. I mean, certainly in the clinic, I don't see pain patients any longer. But when I did, we saw people that had phantom limb pain, intractable pain from accidents, post-operative pain that was intractable. And I saw that everyone that we worked with in the pain clinic had the capacity to markedly diminish, not eliminate. None of them ever eliminated the pain. But we had, you know, migraine headaches that people were able to abort or abate. So we saw all forms of pain where people were able to modify their response to it to a point where an intractable, distracting, debilitating pain became tolerable. So that much it is a certainty. I like your idea for your experiment. It's a good one, but I've seen enough clinical evidence that everyone has this capacity to a more or less degree.
How about teaching it? What if you got some of these people and, you know, some of them, I guess, would be good at teaching it, some of them not, like all teachers are. But why not do an experiment where they teach people that haven't done this before? You know, you don't, maybe you're one of them. You know, you don't put yourself through something terrible, but something small. you know, where usually like an ache or a pain or whatever it is. Let's say you work out hard, you're sore. You know, could they teach you to reduce the soreness, let's say, just with the power of your mind? And what would that show if they're able to teach non-high pain threshold people or non-meditators what to do?
I think
you could do biomarkers and observe changes. I guess there's a lot that could be done, I guess.
I totally agree with you. And that would be a great study. There is one study that I talked about in Change Your Genes at Harvard. There was a study looking at the change in biomarkers, about almost 22,000 biomarkers, epigenetic biomarkers in before and after a 10-week basic relaxation meditation. And all of the biomarkers shifted in a positive regenerative direction. So there was some smart graduate student, there's always one, who said, well, if it takes 10 or 12 weeks, how rapidly can we see these changes? How rapidly can you go from a catabolic, destructive, biological state to an anabolic, constructive, regenerative one? It was kind of the question you're asking, can you learn to do this? And he took a group of people, I think there were 20, maybe 20 people that had not meditated. And he gave them a brief set of instructions and had them meditate for 20 minutes. 20 minutes. Measured their biomarkers before and after a single 20-minute meditation. All of the biomarkers shifted in a positive, regenerative, anabolic state. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, all it takes is one session of meditation and everything's going to be fine. But it does show you how delicate this balance is and how powerful it is when the change is made, that you can affect all your biomarkers in one meditation for 20 minutes. To me, that's astounding. And it begins to kind of get at the question you're raising, which is, can we train ourselves to do that? There's one, maybe I'm talking too much here, but there's one, my favorite study of all time is with NASA. And NASA actually has one of the largest databases on biomarkers and epigenetic expression for identical twins. Now, that may seem strange, and it did to me. And I asked the medical director, who's a friend at NASA, why? And he said, well, to give you an example, Scott Kelly, I think about 3-4 years ago now, spent nearly a year in space, and he has an identical twin brother who's also an astronaut, Mark Kelly, who's married to Gabby Giffords, the U.S. House of Representatives woman who was shot. When he returned, when Scott Kelly returned from roughly a year at the International Space Station, they had all of his before and after biomarkers, which they study very carefully. What they found is that 7% of his biomarkers had changed after 1 year in space. Now, I don't know if 7% is like a little or a lot, but I know from your podcast, you know the only thing that separates humans from chimpanzees is a 1 to less than 2% difference in epigenetic expression.
You mean underlying genes or epigenetic expression?
As you know, genes don't change. The expression is what changes. And so they actually did a follow-up study about 6 months ago. And what they found is that roughly 4%, and these are major things like cellular regeneration and repair, immunological responses to infection, and mitochondrial function at a cellular level, that roughly 4% had regressed. It went back to what they were before his space flight. One of them was telomeres. So his telomeres, or marker of aging, had extended and looked better when he was in space. It actually regressed, and he looks like his normal age after it 4 months ago. But that meant that 3-4% had not changed in nearly 4 years. Now, that's a huge concern for NASA, because they think, well, if 3-4% doesn't change, what does it mean? They have no idea. Could it be that, you know, he's developed an immunity to cancer? Could it be that he's developed a susceptibility to some new and unknown disease? But if we look at long duration spaceflight, that'll last months, if not years. Are you going to have someone on Mars that's no longer a human? Are they going to be so genetically altered they're different than the human race, the way that we are different from the chimpanzees? These are very speculative questions, but it shows you how delicate the balance is between having a stable genetic base and its subsequent expression can be profound.
I don't know. I've thought that many times that there is no evolution. There's just adaptation.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. I mean, because, you know, there's been no evidence really. We've seen a speciation, you know, while we're here. We postulate it's been millions of years. You know, things changed species, but hasn't really been observed. What I have observed is, let's say, retroviruses, which do change the genome, you know, integrate themselves into it, do appear to eventually maybe lead to a split where you get reproductive isolation, like in koalas right now. From what I've learned, is a retrovirus that's infecting them, and the ones that are infected, you know, they're breeding, but the ones that aren't infected are not really breeding with the ones that are, either because of virulence or whatever other reason. But it may change over the entire koala population at one point. Or when you look at, what was it, the cane toads, and it always seems to happen in Australia. The cane toads, and then there was rabbits too that were almost wiped out. They deliberately released a virus and it killed like 99.9% of them. And the survivors were able to get along with the virus. I don't know if they integrated into them, but the population has changed over somewhat because of this. There was a huge culling and now it's different. I guess the point of this is that, epigenetics is using our existing genetic chassis, but retroviruses, I guess, are a way to change the underlying chassis. And then how does it change the overlying epigenetics? I don't know if any of these questions are being looked at. I don't know if, can you go and get lab work done and see your epigenetic marks? And then can anyone interpret it, even if they can see it?
Well, those are loaded observations and questions. Yes, you can get your complete genome mapped at this point in time. It used to be thousands of dollars to do that. It's now a few hundred dollars, and there are maybe a dozen or more companies that actually can map your complete human genome. The trick is, what does it mean? So the analogy is, yes, you can get your entire Library of Congress, but you want to study philosophy, you want to study medicine, astronomy. What is it that you want to study, and how, when you decide what you want to study, do you understand what it is that you're looking at? So it's the challenge of mapping the human genome is, well, it's actually, 20 years ago, the human genome was ostensibly mapped, but it wasn't until about 6 months ago that the dark genome was mapped and was just thought to be empty, useless space. Turns out not to be. It's very, very powerful with the retrovirals. It's thought to be very popular, very potent in terms of determining genetic expression or suppression. So we don't really know how to interpret our own genetic code. That's the biggest challenge for the future. Just this is a bit of an aside, but I'm very optimistic that in the next decade, we're going to see profound changes, particularly in the epigenetics of longevity. There was, the XPRIZE. And in November, the end of November, Peter Diamandis, who's the chairman of the XPRIZE, announced in Qatar a $100 million prize. $100 million prize. And the challenge is between whenever that was, 2023 and 2030, it'll be announced in Qatar. The results are of the competition that the scientists submitting their findings about the impact of deliberately altering epigenetics towards human longevity will be awarded. And it has to be in three areas: psychological, mental, immunological, and physical. So it has to be in all three domains. It has to be stable and it has to be measurable. So you can't just say, we did it. You've got to measure and prove that it was done. Now, when you put a $100 million prize out there, there are about 2,000 research institutes all over the planet that have already begun to compete for that prize. So you can be sure that in the next decade, we're going to find answers to the kind of questions we're raising today definitively. Because of the sheer number of very smart people vying for $100 million. That'll buy a lot of attention, a lot of brain power.
Yeah. Well, okay. What particular research questions do you have at this point? I mean, have you moved on to other areas to explore, or it sounds like you're definitely keeping tabs on what's going on, but I don't know. Are there particular research questions that you're actively researching, or is that not your role anymore?
Well, there are. I'm not. Our group at UCSF is headed by Elizabeth Blackburn, and Elizabeth Blackburn won the Nobel Prize in 2009 for the telomere. So she's really doing the basic research, basic chemistry, the basic epigenetic expression. I'm not involved at that level. My interest is really on the epidemiology of long-lived populations. So there are, as you know, populations called blue zones on the planet where not 20 years from now or 50 years from now, right now, today, regularly live to be 110 years old or more. And my interest, and I visited them and I've talked to Dan Buettner, who wrote the book Blue Zones, about this. My interests are, what are the common lifestyle factors that influence the extension of human life? Not with all of the you know, the rapamycin and the metformin and the GLP inhibitors and the young blood transfusions, all the bells and whistles that we know are out there. But what are communities and individuals doing right now, different places on the world where on a regular basis they live to be 110? That to me is the interesting question. And we've, in our group here, we've called it the divine dozen. And we've tentatively come up with 12 common characteristics among these people. And I'm really exploring that. I'm really trying to see, are these predictive? Are they stable over time? Do they in fact represent the commonalities between the blue zones? That to me is kind of fascinating because it's immediately applicable. It doesn't take a breakthrough in science to make this happen.
You know, early on when we talked about people meditating to, you know, alleviate pain, has anyone meditated with the intention of making themselves younger? And if so, what's happened?
Yeah. Well, that's certainly, I mean, that's going to have to be part of the, any intervention at the human level. We did do it. There is a study that Elizabeth Blackburn did here at UCSF a couple of years ago, actually. She did a 12-week intervention, group intervention with, I've forgotten how many patients, but it had meditation, had basically a Mediterranean diet, moderate aerobic activity, and social support among the people in that group. And she was able to demonstrate that you could extend the telomere. You could make the arms longer and the tips of the telomere more intact in 12 weeks by doing this group intervention. Now, that has a lot of parallels and similarities to what you see in the long-lived cultures, because one of the things you do find, again, in all of these cultures, is all of them have a meditative life.
Oh, you know, I had asked you, you know, has anyone, well, you talked about the Elizabeth Blackburn, how she had done a 10 or 12 week class with meditation and other things, and the telomeres lengthened. And then we were going from there.
Okay. So the results of that study that Elizabeth Blackburn conducted was that the telomeres actually lengthened and the caps or the tips of the telomere became more intact. So that's be indicative of an extension of life expectancy. And that's in 12 weeks. And the characteristics of the intervention were the same as what you would find in the blue zone communities. So all of the blue zones, one of the 12 characteristics is that they all have, they're not necessarily orthodoxly religious, but they all have a religious belief that their life has a purpose, that life writ large has a purpose, and they have a purpose in it. So they're never, you don't find incidents of depression or malaise or ennui. These people are alive and vital. And I think that any intervention at the human level that we're going to see coming out of the XPRIZE in the next decade is going to have to include this kind of meditation, or if you will, spiritual dimension that will be responsible for extended life expectancy.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. Well, very good, Ken. What's the best place for people to find out more about your work? Like, let's start with the book. You know, what was or is the release date? I didn't know. And then we'll talk about your other work.
Sure. Well, it's, they can always find out more. My website is drpelletier.com. There are articles and videos. It's all free. And the book is Change Your Genes, Change Your Life. It just came out about 6 months ago. I've forgotten the exact release date, but it's available from Amazon. So thank you for asking about that.
Okay. So that's available on Amazon. People can Google you and find it on your map. Okay, excellent. You know, last question. So in the next, I mean, you spoke about the XPRIZE and the possibility there. So in the next 10 years, what do you think will be possible or maybe even commonplace in this arena?
That's a great question. And I think, let's say 10 years from now, I think the likelihood that we will see extended human life expectancy bordering on extreme longevity, and by extreme longevity, I mean in excess of 120 years old, will be more common. It'll be more common globally. Because if you look at the population of the planet, the entire population of the planet is graying and getting older. There are more people that are centenarians on the planet right now. By 2050, there'll be over 1 billion people on the planet in excess of 100 years old as compared to now. So that's an astounding finding. I think we're going to see a radical change in human population. Longer life expectancy with both pluses and minuses. The pluses are obvious. The minuses are we going to outlive our social security? What do we do with people that are living longer and may need more care, if you will? But I think those are going to be resolved, and we will see a healthy lifespan, health span, if you will, of 120 and above in about a decade.
Yeah, that would be crazy. It'd be amazing.
It will be.
Okay. Well, very good, Ken. It's been really great to speak to you. And, you know, I appreciate it. Hopefully I'll have you back shortly to talk about more of this, these amazing discoveries. And I guess for now, don't watch horror movies and don't watch people that are able to put needles through various parts of their body to save your sanity.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I really enjoyed your questions and our conversation. So thank you for the invitation, and I will look forward to the future.
Excellent.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.